Good evening. I have intentionally chosen not to avail myself of technology tonight. You thought I was a slave of it. You're probably right, but not tonight. So I invite you to turn open to the text of Mark chapter 15. And our lesson tonight will be from verses 21 to the end of the chapter. And I do hope that you'll have your own Bible in front of you. If you didn't bring one, there are those in the pew, and I will be reading from time to time from the New American Standard Version on this particular occasion. I grew up in a land of art. Can't help but think of illustrations when I listen to a lesson, when I'm preparing one, when I want to head into one. And I might have to use a verbal description of one because I've chosen not to use technology. I grew up in Florence, Italy, because my parents were missionaries, and it was in the 11th and 12th century that over in that part of the world, in Europe, and in particular in the Valley of Florence and Siena and many other medieval cities, they began constructing some of the great cathedrals that you can visit still today. There are edifices that have been there now for 1,000 years or longer. There was a building boom, a mania, that began in the 11th century in the aftermath of the non-return of Christ and of recovered wealth and population and drive to build houses of God, cathedrals in the midst of the urban centers of the time. There's one that was about 20 minutes from the home where I lived in Tuscany for about 2 years called San Gimignano. It's a cathedral that goes back to the Romanesque period, and it's remarkable. It's not one of the most beautiful, but it has a vivid illustration of what they were trying to do in the 11th and 12th century. When people could not read, only about 5 to 10% could. When no one had their own copy of their own Bible, they were not allowed to by church laws, rules. And besides, the printing press hadn't been invented yet, so it was impossible to own your own Bible. And so they would need to resort to pictures, to paintings. In fact, in San Gimignano, when you go in, there's paintings on the left wall and paintings on the right. And the challenge of the artist was to put on the left side the most critical moments of the Old Testament. Imagine if you had that job of selecting what vignettes, what would you want to do with regard to the Old Testament? Which ones would you put up that would start from the beginning of the Old Testament and the creation all the way to the prophets? On the right side, you can expect the New Testament. And of course, the story starts with the birth of Jesus, but it has to end, and yes, usually, and that's the way it is in San Gimignano on the right side. When you get down the right side of the wall that leads up to the main altar, there is the depiction of the crucifixion, and then, of course, the end of the story, which is the resurrection. Bible in stone, that's the term for it. They had to put the Bible on painted frescoes on walls because that was the way in which you could refer to it and say, that's what happened. That's a hero of the faith. That's what this is all about. That's why we're here. All of the above. I began appreciating at some point the way in which men of the Middle Ages, artists, and of the Renaissance started portraying the events, if you have to summarize it. And I was amazed by one in particular that I have to describe to you because I'm not showing PowerPoints tonight. Mantegna is his name, Andrea, and he painted a particular scene of the crucifixion of Christ as a backdrop to a church called San Zeno, and it's on the back altarpiece. And it's the crucifixion scene. And I guess I was 25 years into my faith. I was baptized when I was 13. I was somewhere in my late 30s before I realized that Mark, the Gospel of Mark chapter 15, does an amazing job of highlighting faces around the cross. I knew the story. I'd grown up with it. So maybe you did too. But have you ever noticed, all I'm asking in this 20 minutes tonight, maybe that you discover with me like I did a few years back, looking at a painting and then going to the Gospel of Mark, chapter 15 and verse 21 to the end of the chapter, how he highlights, spotlights faces around the cross. Faces around the cross. It's amazing. One more thing about the art piece, which you can go look up if you'd like and view. It's like bathed in a neon light, which of course is 5 centuries before we invented electric light or neon. But it's like he spotlighted. Maybe he had read Mark 15, 21 and had gotten it. Of course, in the center are the 3 crosses. But it's the other people around the cross that are spotlighted just as well. Yes, the subject matter is the crucifixion. It's that moment in time. It's that crucial moment in time. Come back, if you would, with Mark chapter 15 to AD 30 and to the most important event in human history ever, ever, ever. He spotlights the women. There's some soldiers that are playing dice down on the floor. There's some passersby. There's the landscape of Jerusalem in the background, the city that was supposed to house the temple of God, and where they should have recognized the Messiah, but they didn't. They were the ones that yelled, "Crucify him, crucify him, crucify him." The Romans are only doing their bidding. They are the ones that want that man, that innocent man, the only innocent man that has ever been, to die on that cross in the middle. Well, Mark chapter 15, verse 21. Please mark, note that Mark is a synoptic gospel, but he's a little different than the others. He's the shortest. He omits some of the facts of other accounts. He only gives a few of Jesus' sayings on the cross. There are 7 overall. He only decides to put in a few, and his focus is mainly on the faces that are around the cross. And this lesson is about those who stood around the cross. And I submit to you that the same attitudes are assembled today. The question is, where do we stand? Where do we stand around the cross? Verse 21. They pressed into service a passerby coming from the country, Simon of Cyrene, the father of Alexander and Rufus, to bear his cross. This is the one who was compelled to carry the cross. Simon is his name. He's at the right place at the right time, or you could say he's at the wrong place at the wrong time. Depends on your perspective, I guess. He's coming from Cyrene. That's in Africa. We call it Libya today. Was he dark-skinned? Color? His origins might denote that much. Only Egyptians are white Africans. The rest are dark-skinned. But that's really not the point. What bad luck to be there for what? Are you there for the Passover? Is that why you're there, Simon? Or are you there for business? Why are you there? We can raise the questions, but we don't know. What we know is that there was an unwelcome intrusion into his life suddenly as a spear. The law said that if you get tapped on the shoulder by a Roman soldier, the Romans own all the Mediterranean world, everybody knows the law, then you have got to carry a Roman backpack for a mile. Jesus will use that as an illustration. And in this case, it's not a backpack. It's a patibulum. It's the wooden part of one of the main methods of the Roman Empire to put people to death. And that's the part that you tie the man to, the man of the 3 that is in this procession that he maybe had noticed but did not care about probably until the point in which he got tapped on the shoulder. He is told, you need to carry this patibulum because he can't. And we know why he can't, because you just read Matthew chapter 15, the first few verses. They have scourged him. You do know what that means, right? You do know. They have spat upon him. They have ridiculed him. I don't suppose that Jesus of Nazareth was a weakling, but after he'd been through a scourging, he was stumbling. Simon, that was a day that changed his life. I'd like to know a whole lot more. Acts chapter 13 and verse 1, has, you don't have to go to it, has a list of church leaders in Antioch of Syria, and a Simon called Niger, which means black in Latin, is one of the leaders. And we wonder, is that him? Because, by the way, in the text, when it says in Mark 15, he was the father of Alexander and Rufus, we ask ourselves, well, why did Mark point out that this Simon that got tapped on the shoulder was the father of Alexander and Rufus, unless the early church knew them? What happened to Simon after the tap on the shoulder, after the day in which he had to carry for half a mile a patibulum of a man he had never met before, who was about to die? Did that day change his life forever? Romans chapter 16 and verse 13 says, mentions in the greetings of a letter by the Apostle Paul many decades later, mentions a Rufus. A Rufus is mentioned, whose mother had been very helpful to Paul. And she just might be, maybe the wife of Simon. So now, if I can dare to put all this picture together, this is a day that changed the life of a guy called Simon, who happened to be at the right place at that right time. The Roman guards were used that day to bring a person that had no intention of entering the kingdom of heaven, or to getting information about it. And a tap on the shoulder by a Roman guard brought him to that occasion. Verse 22. Then they brought him to the place called Golgotha, which is translated place of the skull. They tried to give him wine mixed with myrrh, but he did not take it. And they crucified him and divided up his garments among themselves, casting lots for them to decide what each man should take. It was the third hour when they crucified him. The inscription on the charge against him read, "The King of the Jews." I've underlined four times in those verses I just read, 22 to 26, they. And we know who the they are. They don't have to be mentioned by Mark. They are the professional military overlords of the world. They are the garrison of 1,000 that are there in Jerusalem. I don't know how many of them were appointed to do crucifixions, executions, the execution squads. They executed by firing squad. They executed by decapitation. They executed by crucifixion, which was slow and deliberate. And I have to suppose that they had done it more than once. They had done it. Maybe it was their turn. It was a Friday, so they did executions on a Friday. I don't know how many there were, but they are mentioned there. They, the Roman soldiers, the ones who erected the cross, let it drop into the hole. For them, I guess it was just another day. I don't want to read too much out of the text or into it. But I have to guess come out of it saying you can become so calloused that you don't recognize, see anything. Dividing up the robes that are there while he looks on. Jesus could see them right at the feet, right? He could see what they were doing. When he said, "Forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing," that included those human beings who callously were just simply dividing up his robes and nothing more. Careless indifference. If the issue of Simon was one of busy, and then God, whammo, comes into your life in a second, then this is, you are not busy, you're too indifferent to notice even what's going on around you. Careless indifference. Still today, there seems to be plenty of that attitude and around. It's sad, but I guess it shouldn't surprise. Verse 27. They crucified two robbers with him, one on his right and one on his left. And then skip down to verse 32. Those who were crucified with him were also insulting him. The criminals. In a Wednesday night devotional, I think I had an occasion to tell you that the passage from Luke, that gospel writer, is so marvelous as it gives us more insight into that conversation that took place between three dying men there. Mark does not give you that conversation, but you know it, right? He was crucified between them. That had been prophesied. It happened just like it had been prophesied. There are dozens of prophecies that came true on that day. He had fulfilled dozens of others that had been spoken by the prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Micah, from centuries before. In that day, on that Friday, a ton more. And one of them was that he would be crucified among trespassers. And that definitely happened, one on the right and one on the left. What's amazing is to conceive of anybody hurling insult as they are dying towards somebody else that they didn't even know up to that point. And the realization from Luke comes that one of them knew that they were actually dying because they were guilty of trespassing the law. Not just stealing an apple, probably. The term can mean terrorist. They had violated the law. They knew the punishment. They are dying because they violated the law. But the man in the middle, one of them knows, he's innocent. He's innocent. He's innocent. Luke does tell the story of the one that looks into Jesus and stops at some point, ceases. Why did he stop? What did he see? The other one continues, getting his last laughs as he dies in pain and suffering in the dying of the one in the middle, while the other one looks upon and suddenly changes. And remember me when you are in paradise. And Jesus says, you will be with me on this day. And Brother Gray reminded us in our class this morning of that important event there. Well, they had never experienced the miracles of Jesus. That I know of, they had never met him. So how is it that the one on the right changed, differed, two different attitudes? How does that happen? One looked into the eyes of the Son of God and saw himself, and the other just saw absolutely nothing, nothing. Remember me. And the other one is instead casting insults with his last few breaths. Remember me. You will be with me today in paradise. Wow. To have that kind of certainty. You know, today, you will be with me in paradise. You do have that certainty, don't you? You're in Christ tonight? Yeah. Verse 29 through 32. Those passing by were hurling abuse at him, wagging their heads and saying, "Ha! You who are going to destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself and come down from the cross." In the same way, the chief priests, along with the scribes, were mocking him among themselves and saying, "He saved others. He cannot save himself. Let this Christ, the King of Israel, now come down from the cross so that we may see and believe." The passers-by. These are the passers-by, the ones who ridiculed Jesus on the cross. These are the ones for whom religion is just a game. Religion is just a game. And it still surprises me when I find people playing religion as just a game and treating religion as just a game. Game to for politics, for political gain, a game for economic reasons. There are lots of people that are still using religion and Christ and the cross and Christianity as a game. They do it to make money. It's just a game. They're haughty. They're arrogant. I'm not going to assume that they're disbelievers. They might even actually believe. But you can believe and be haughty and arrogant and play fast and loose with religion and with things that are sacred. You can be sacrilegious, all of the above. What makes people like that? How do we keep ourselves from going there? How do we prevent our children and the next generation from becoming more sacrilegious than our culture already is with regard to sacred things and the cross and the one who died for their sins? How do you become this way? There were passers-by that were going to market on that Friday. They were busy maybe in the festivities of the Passover, which was a festivity that lasted 8 days. The big meal had just happened on Thursday. On Saturday, they were going by an execution. The Sabbath was going to start in a few hours, and they made fun of someone dying. How do you avoid becoming that way? Verse 34 through 36. When the sixth hour came, darkness fell over the whole land until the ninth hour, and at the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," which is translated, my God, why have you forsaken me? Why have you forsaken me?" 36 is the key. And some bystanders heard it. They began saying, "Behold, he is calling for Elijah." And someone ran and filled a sponge with sour wine and put it on a reed and gave it to him to drink, saying, "Let us see whether Elijah will come and take him down." It's that someone. Is that how verse 36 starts for you there in your text? Somebody said, the bystanders heard him say those words, my God, why have you forsaken me?" in the Aramaic language. And they heard those words, and then one in particular ran and filled a sponge with sour wine, vinegar wine. The question is, why was he trying to help out the dying man? Was he trying to offer relief to the strong dehydration of the crucified man? Or was he more likely trying to delay his death so that he might get one more laugh, some more entertainment out of that? The crucifixion, by all accounts, starts at 9 o'clock in the morning. And then there's 3 hours of darkness that we just read about. So around after the 3 o'clock time period is when Christ dies. He dies early, so that when the guard comes to break the bones of the other two that are by him, to hurry up, speed up their death, because by the sun going down, they had to have them off the cross and in the tombs. He finds that the one in the middle has his suffering was not prolonged as long as they could have. It was only from 9 to 3, only 6 or 7 hours of suffering rather than 9, which was, I guess, the potential on this particular day. The nameless man of verse 36, what was he trying to do? Was he motivated by good things, or was he trying to just, was he getting a laugh out of this, you know? Was he getting a laugh out of it? That's, I guess, the question that I like to know. Was he just curious? There are people that approach Christianity and sacred things with just curiosity. That's a good thing to start with. Welcome curiosity, but if curiosity turns into entertainment at the story of Christ, then I guess this is where we've lost you. You've lost sight of what's there. Jesus dies. Jesus dies. That's recorded in the verse that follows, verse 37. Jesus uttered a loud cry, breathed his last. The veil of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. Jesus dies, and that moment, the critical aspect of the most sad moment in time is signified by, some say it was 30 foot, some say it was 90 foot tall curtain just splitting in half. And then the centurion, verse 39. When the centurion who was standing right in front of him saw the way he breathed his last, he said, "Truly, this man was the Son of God." The one who acknowledged the cross. So he's commanding several soldiers who don't recognize, but how did he know the difference? How did he, the commander, the ones that's in charge, the centurion? A legend later on will say that we know the name of this man. We don't. Longinus. You'll find statues dedicated to a Longinus. Tradition says that the centurion's name was Longinus and went on to be a follower of Christ and die a martyr even to Christ. But the reality is, we don't know. But the point is, what did he say? What did he mean when he looked up? The others are casting die, the men that he commanded. But he looked up. What did he see? What was the difference with him, the centurion? A career military man, used to giving orders. Theoretically, he should be the most calloused of all, and yet he saw for the first time, he detected, he heard, which words were they? Which of the seven sayings of Jesus on the cross that we have recorded? Got you, got your heart. He said, "Wow, I just witnessed moral perfection. I saw it, I heard it in a dying man." Which one? Which one of the sayings? When he took care of his mother? Or when he said, "Forgive them for they don't know what they're doing"? Which one? Did he hear the last words before he died? "It is finished." There's a whole gigantic lesson in those words. that Jesus spoke in Aramaic, they come to us in Greek. In your language, it comes out to three words. It is finished. And you've got to understand what the it is. It is finished. Is that the words that got the centurion? Did you hear them? What's finished? Your life? The price? The suffering? It is finished. The plan of God to rescue us from the mess that we made in the Garden of Eden. It's finally in place, set, and it's ready to go. When in a few weeks, the Holy Spirit will come and begin the kingdom of heaven. The foundations have been laid. Did he understand all that stuff? You do, because you have scripture and you know. Did he understand what made him look up and see? Deep conviction is what seized him. What did he see when he looked up? How do you get a ha-ha moment like that? I dare to say there might be somebody in this audience tonight that needs an aha moment. What are you waiting for? There were a lot of people that missed the aha moment on that day. The question is, do you have to? Or can you look up? And can you say, truly this was the Son of God? He became tragically aware of the ghastly mistake that they had made on that day. He became aware of the character and nature of Jesus of Nazareth. In those few hours, he got to see him for about 6 to 9 hours between the crucifixion preparations and the hanging on the cross part. Deep conviction can hit you suddenly. Why not tonight? Why can't you accept who he was tonight? If you're not in Christ, why not? Deep conviction. All around might not see it, but if you can perceive it, if you can see it, if you can look up, look up. Quit looking around, look up. Quit being distracted by the many that are rejecting, making fun of, spitting, scourging, laughing, being blasphemous. Verse 40. There were also some women looking on the distance, among whom were Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, the less, and Joseph, and Salome. And when he was in Galilee, they used to follow him and minister to him. And there were many other women who came up with him to Jerusalem. The women. I've had occasion, I guess, in another class setting to say, where are the men on this critical occasion? James, Peter, and the rest of them behind a closed door somewhere on the other side of Jerusalem. John had been there earlier with Mary at the cross, but they're not mentioned in this particular setting. Where are they? Have they turned away because it was just too much? Only ones left there are mentioned right there. There are the women. Can you imagine can we try to imagine the emotions? Bewilderment, heartbroken, the depth of sorrow, drenched in sorrow indeed. They loved Jesus so much, however, that they could not be somewhere else. That's it. You learn to love Jesus so much that you cannot but stand up for him. You cannot but stay there. You cannot but be there. I've got to. I cannot leave. I am not going to shrink back. I am going to stand up for him. I'm going to stand up for truth. They were the last to be with Jesus, the women, and they were the first to behold his resurrection. See Mary Magdalene, who comes to the tomb on the first day of the week. If nothing else, this is clearly a wonderful tribute to the spiritual sensitivity of women. God bless the women. And then, verse 42 through 47. When evening had already come, because it was the preparation day, that is, the day before the Sabbath, Joseph of Arimathea came, a prominent member of the council, who himself was waiting for the kingdom of God. And he gathered up courage and went up in before Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus. Pilate wondered if he was dead by this time, and summoning the centurion, he questioned him as to whether he was already dead. And ascertaining that from the centurion, he granted the body of Joseph, and Joseph bought a linen cloth, took him down, wrapped him in the linen cloth, laid him in the tomb, which had been hewn out of the rock, and he rolled a stone against the entrance of the tomb. Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of Joseph, were looking on to see where he was laid. Joseph is the secret disciple who came out at the cross. John confirms that too. He was a secret disciple, member of the Sanhedrin, but he feared the Jews. He feared his fellow Sanhedrin members. He was a good and upright man. He didn't agree, I suppose, with the decision of the Sanhedrin to put him to death. He did not yell, "Crucify him, crucify him." Yet there is no evidence that he stood up in the middle of Sanhedrin and said, "This is wrong. This is wrong. Don't do it." So maybe you haven't stood up like Joseph of Arimathea before for Christ, but there's a good time to do that. This would be a good time. He comes out now. So silence. Silence kills. If it doesn't kill us, it kills the people to whom we don't talk about Jesus. We don't take Jesus. Silence kills. It dampens us. It demotes us. It steals our evangelistic spirit, silence does. And it definitely may prevent you from, well, being the one that taps Simon on the shoulder and tells him about the cross. Silence is not good. silence kills. But after his death, he finally stood up to be counted. The sight of the Jews' death on the cross was more evidently than he could take. And he said, "That's it, enough already." And he comes out. And so here we are. And we are at the conclusion of our reading. So how's your heart when you come to the cross each time? Let your heart be laid bare. Look up. The cross removes hypocrisy. It shows us for who we are. What do you see? How important is it to you? Even if you're here by accident tonight, there is no accident in God's universe. You're here intentionally. If you are plagued with a small dose of indifference, how can we get rid of it? How can we encourage you to understand how dangerous that is? Are you able to look into the eyes of Jesus on the cross and fall in love again and again and again? It is required. It is necessary. All you have to do is look, and you'll see the same thing each time. The kind of love for you that required him to go through that kind of suffering simply for you and you alone and me alone. So are you able to look up? Are you able to be like the centurion and declare today, "Truly, this is the Son of God"? So hearts are laid bare at the cross. Would you come as we stand and sing?